Hi, my name is Barbara Theodosiou from The Addict's Mom. I'm here today with my partner, Christina Rowe, and with Joe Herzanek. Joe is an author, speaker, addictions counselor, president, Changing Lives Foundation, former chaplain of Boulder County Jail. Joe Herzanek has spent over 17 years working in the criminal justice system as the former chaplain for the Boulder County and their families. He's an expert on recovery from drug and alcohol addiction, a state-certified addiction counselor, author of the award-winning book, Why Don't They Just Quit?, former host of Recovery Television, speaker and founder of Changing Life Foundation. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Barbara. It's great to be with you today.
Yeah, and it's great to have you on. I'm really thrilled, you know, to be able to have your expertise on our call today. I wanted to speak to you a little bit. The topic today we're going to talk about is, what do you do when you've tried everything, when you've been doing this for years with your addicted child? What should a mom do when she's just at the end of her rope?
Okay, that's a great topic. Actually, I get a lot of calls and emails about that. And, you know, and this is for the person or the mom that has, you know, maybe their child's been in different rehab programs. The substance abuse, the drugs or alcohol abuse has gone on for at least a few years, often much longer than that. Mom and dad have tried everything they can to sort of get through to this person. And at that point, I think what we need to talk about is a firm tough love, not a mean tough love, but just set out a plan, an approach to deal with this in an objective manner. And one of the things that I talk about is the parent usually has some leverage. I mean, they're helping the child with their rent or their car payment or providing a car or they're paying for their cell phone. They're doing these kinds of things. So that's the leverage that a person can use. Especially if in the case where the child, whether it's an adolescent or an adult child, is still living at home, there's some things that you can use to sort of get their attention. And what I suggest is that you make it one of the requirements to continue to get the support from the family is to be willing to go through a period of like a probation period, you might say. In other words, tell the person that you've pretty much worn out from this whole situation. It's causing tremendous stress. You love your child. You have great concern. You want the best for your child. But this is what we're going to do now. And what I talk about is telling this person that they need to attend a 12-step recovery group or a mandatory outpatient group, some type of support group. And the problem that comes in is the ability to monitor this. How do we know that they're really going to a 12-step meeting or going to their group? How do we know that they're really maintaining their sobriety? So in tough cases, and that's what we're talking about now, tough cases, there's several things that you can do. I have a form that I will send to a lot of moms, and it's a form where the person will go to a 12-step group, and they will have to have the facilitator of the group put their name and phone number down so that mom or dad can spot check and make sure that they're really attending these groups. Now, one of the most difficult things is to really monitor sobriety. How do I know that this person is really not using? Maybe they've cut back and it's hard to tell. How do I know that they're really maintaining abstinence? And anybody can get on the internet. In fact, the local grocery store, just a few blocks from my house, sells drug testing kits. So I would tell the person that they have to maintain their sobriety and attend support groups, and it's for a period of time, like 30 days or 60 days. You decide what time length you want, but a minimum of 30 days, and usually 60 or 90 days is better. So they go to these support groups, they have their sheet of paper signed, and they do random drug testing. Mom and dad can do a random drug test right in the home. They're pretty inexpensive. If you go on the internet, there's dozens of resources and places to buy drug testing kits, and they will cover any particular substance that you may think that the person's using, or some of them cover a dozen or more substances. So, and this is done all over the country by the criminal justice system. When a person is put on probation, they're not incarcerated any longer, they have to go in for monitored sobriety tests. They have to do a breathalyzer or a urine test of some kind to determine whether they're really staying abstinent from drugs. And it's not that, you know, this comes once the person has reached this point where as much as you love them and care about them, it's just hard to trust. I mean, addicts and alcoholics, and I'm a long-term recovered addict myself, but just being completely truthful and honest, those were just options. So for a period of time, to trust, yes, but also to verify. That's really important for the family.
That sounds wonderful. There's, you know, a lot of different cases we can apply that to. And I want to talk about the two different options. Like, one is, like, in my case where my son won't be living in my house versus the mother whose child is living in her house. So how do you handle both of those situations, starting with the child that doesn't live in your house? How do you use the system?
Well, when the child doesn't live in the house, it's much more difficult because he has somehow or another managed to find a place to live. And so that portion that parents often provide, a place to live, they figured a way to take care of that on their own. Now, if you are giving any financial support, let's say, for instance, that this adolescent or young adult child is going to school and you're paying half their rent, if they're local, you can still do these random drug tests. You can say the same thing. You need to stop by. I'm going to call you a couple times a week, and I want you to stop by and do a random drug test. And if you fail those things, then I'm not going to be able to supplement your rent, because the bottom line is drugs cost money. Alcohol costs money. So if you're supplying money for their rent, you are actually buying drugs. And the reason I say that is because if you're paying the rent, then you're freeing up other money to be spent for drugs and alcohol. So, when the person is not living at home, you can still, and if they're in the same town or close by, you can still do the random drug testing thing. And you can still do the 12-step or the support recovery groups as well. Now, we're talking about serious situations. Chronic drug abuse, addiction, if it's left alone, it's going to get progressively worse over time, and oftentimes it's fatal. So this is what you do. In essence, you're trying to save the person's life. You're also trying to end all the drama and heartache that goes on in your own home. But if they don't want to do this, then fine. Then let them find their own way to pay for their rent and their tuition or whatever that might be.
What happens, though, if you cut off financial support and then they just go out and steal? So they don't get caught and they don't get, arrested for it. I mean.
Okay, well, eventually they will get caught. And if the person chooses to sort of enter the criminal lifestyle, if they get caught, they're going to spend some time in jail. Usually, this starts out gradually. It could be shoplifting. It could be, I don't know what, it could be writing a check or charging money to the parent's credit card without permission. And this will end up in a short-term incarceration, a few weeks, a month, maybe a couple months. And this sometimes is a real eye-opening experience also for the person. They need to decide, is this really the lifestyle that I want? I mean, and sometimes going to jail, in fact, working in a jail, I've had hundreds of people tell me that going to jail was the best thing that ever happened to them. And it's because they started to see the high cost of maintaining their drug use.
Okay. In fact, my son is in jail right now. And what you're talking about, I think it is a real eye-opener for him. And, you know, we spoke about you and I, my having a plan in place, you know, which is, you know, your plan is what we spoke about if he relapses, that he would have to have 30 days clean before we had a relationship, and we kind of compromised in the middle. Because my son is 19 years old, we said that, you and I, when we spoke, that I would be willing to pay for him to be in a halfway house, you know, pay the first month or two till he got a job, and I would have to verify that he went to meetings through the sheet and also verify through the halfway house manager or whoever that he did have 30 days clean before we can resume having a family relationship, which is really, really important to him.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. You know, there are lots and lots of sober living homes all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're in Florida.
Yes.
And there are just thousands of them in Florida. Florida is loaded with recovery resources. So
mm-hmm.
a sober living home is a great option. They,
mm-hmm.
they can be very inexpensive. Many of them do the drug testing themselves. Many
right.
of them do require that they attend a 12-step group. And the entire group, is if it's a house with 10, 12, or 14 guys, big house, a bunch of guys living in it, they all have to go to the recovery meeting, so they go together, and it's a lot easier. So, you know, until the person gets, you know, a few months or more of sobriety, it's a high maintenance issue. It's difficult early on in sobriety, but that's just the way it is. I mean, the only other option is to continue on with the insane lifestyle until something really bad happens. So my mom and dad, a parent, should not feel bad about this. I mean, this is not something you do with your 14-year-old that you just found a joint of marijuana in his backpack. We're talking about someone who has created great havoc, great stress over a few years or more with the family. At that point, you just really need to put down some tough love. And if you don't talk to this person for a month or maybe 6 weeks because they won't conform to the requirements, then that's not the end of the world. It's not like you're telling them, I'm never going to talk to you again as long as you live. No, it's just a short period of time that you want to be able to highly monitor their activity around drug use.
Now, Joe, I have a question for you, because I know most mothers, I don't know if you'd agree with this, who are in this situation now, it started probably way back in the teen years where the kids probably got their way and were maybe manipulative, and there was this enabling going on for quite some time. So for a mother now hearing this, to gather the strength, where did they get the strength to all of a sudden be a different kind of parent who could
mm-hmm.
follow through with this? Because if you've had, I have teenagers, two teenage boys who, you know, were sort of a wimpy parent. They've driving me crazy right now, not necessarily with drugs, but they, you know, and I'm trying to change now, and it's really hard to get, and I could only imagine, you know, somebody in this situation having to change the way they parent. Like, where do you get
right.
that strength from?
Well, that's a very, very good question, because you can't really do this unless you are mentally and emotionally prepared to do it. And that preparation and the encouragement to follow through on this commitment, because you're making a commitment too. You don't want to tell the kid that you're going to do this and then 3 days later give in. So you need encouragement from support groups. Al-Anon is great. Even I believe on your website that moms can chat back and forth about the things that are going on. So, I mean, right in the middle of the day, if you have a computer and you have a question and, you know, there's somebody online that you can chat with. But it's really good to be physically around moms or parents that are going through the identical situation, because it just tells you that you're not alone. Because moms, most people feel really alone. I can't tell you how many times I picked up the phone and the mom says, I'm just so alone. I'm a single mom and I'm trying to do the best I can. I've never dealt with this before. I don't know what to do. So being alone with your own thoughts is not a good idea. I mean,
mm-hmm.
to at least attend once or twice a week, more if possible, in the early stages of helping this person make this critical life change, the support is very, very important.
And then maybe even have like an accountability partner in that to hold you accountable,
right,
for not giving into the child, or, you know, like...
Absolutely, absolutely. When you go to a group like this, it's not just to go and sit and be a spectator, so to speak. It's to join in and become part of it. Get a couple of phone numbers from other moms that you've, that talk at the meeting, and, you know, that you seem to maybe feel like you can connect with. Get some phone numbers, somebody you can call. Because, you know, to meet with a counselor, a psychiatrist, or something like that can be very expensive. And to be honest, you know, a well-trained psychiatrist can help with some real severe mental and emotional issues. But the bottom line is, if you got a couple of moms that are close by that are dealing with the identical, and I mean, they're, if you go to enough groups, you'll find someone with the identical situation. And that mom, that other person, can give you a lot of encouragement. You can encourage each other. And you can sort of hold each other accountable to stick with the ultimatum, you might say, that you've given.
Now, Joe, I want to ask you something, because the big thing, what I hear over and over on the Addict's Mom, and the really big thing seems to have shifted. It used to be, especially for me in the early years of my son's addictions, was like, oh, my God, he'll go to jail. And today it's like, oh, my God, thank God he's in jail. You know, because,
right,
you know, thank God I don't have to worry tonight. I'm not going to get a call at 4 in the morning. The big fear,
right,
today with me and many of the moms on the Addict's Mom is, oh, my God, now I've said you have to be clean for 30 days. I've put you in this sober living environment. You didn't follow the rules, and now I have to stick to it, and now you're on the street. It's the street. It is so scary to say, oh, my God, my kid has no place to sleep. He has no place. It's that fear of following through, because it's not like you're saying, okay, I'm taking your phone for the week, you know, or I'm doing this.
Right.
You know, you're literally,
right,
you know, going into a situation. When you've come to the end of this period where it's just so severe, like in my case, when you've tried, like, the phones and the this and the that, and the only option is either I pay your rent, you stay sober, or you go on the street. How do you mentally deal with your child being on the street? It's just so scary.
Well, that's another good question. What you have to do is calmly, by yourself, sit down and think about the consequences. You need to start asking yourself the question, like, what's the right thing to do? Because I want to be sure and do whatever that is, the right thing to do, and I want to be sure and avoid the wrong thing. So, and you can just write down on a piece of paper, the wrong thing is to continue to support this lifestyle by enabling, by giving a little money now and then, by paying his utility bill when the electricity goes off. And this can be hard, because maybe this is like a 23 or 24-year-old adult child that has a,
mm-hmm,
has a wife and a couple of kids at home, and he calls and says that the utilities company is coming out tomorrow to turn off the power. Well, let him come out. It's not the end of the world. People don't just fall over and die when something like that happens. They figure it out, and hopefully they learn a lesson, because addicts and alcoholics typically learn best through the consequences of their poor choices. Painful consequences can do so much more than you and I could ever dream of doing.
Even if it's the street?
And living on the street, first of all, in the case of like a 19-year-old, for instance,
mm-hmm,
typically a 19-year-old has plenty of buddies, and he can go couch surfing for an
mm-hmm
extended period of time. Eventually, his friends will get tired of that.
Mm-hmm.
And to live on the street is a really inconvenient way to live.
Yes.
And most are not going to like that. So the trade-off is they have to have their little epiphany. They have to realize that my substance abuse is costing me a great deal. And ultimately, the question is, which is more important, my relationship with the people who love me, my own flesh and blood, or is it the relationship I have with this drug issue and this drug lifestyle? And you can tell them just point blank, as much as we love you, Johnny, here's the deal. We're not going to do anything to help this lifestyle in any way. We want to have a relationship with you. But until you make that choice, which relationship is the most important to you? I mean, is it your family or is it all these, is it the drugs and the drug lifestyle? Because you can't have both. As much as we love you, as much as we want you around and to be able to talk and communicate with you, we don't want your disease. We don't want this drug addiction in our lives. It's just too painful to watch. And the thing about moms, because literally 95% of all my calls and emails are come from moms. It's either a mom or a wife who has a son, a daughter, a spouse that's in trouble. And it's almost built, not almost, it is built into the DNA of moms to be concerned, very concerned about the child that they bore in their own bodies and brought into the world. To just turn their back on that is a terrifying thought. But if you see it as just a temporary time frame and as a tool that will help repair the life of this person, then it's easier to do. And that's why
right.
you put down on paper, this is the right thing to do, this is the wrong thing to do. And then trying to emotionally detach from what's right and what's wrong. Because sometimes doing the right thing is also painful. And that's why, like you mentioned a minute ago, how do I stay mentally and emotionally stable to do this? And that's where the groups and that's where the other moms all come in.
Right. I wanted to ask you, we had talked about when you and I had spoken a while back, you said you do an exercise with moms, have them write out on a piece of paper, like you said, a letter to their addicted child on what, you know, they plan to do and just everything we just spoke about.
Right.
And then, you know, we had talked about a lot of different answers and resistance you come up against. For instance, when my son calls me from jail, he'll be like, you just don't understand. Like, you know, how bad it is when I have a craving. Like, it's real serious. Like, he almost wants to get me on that same page that, like, if I relapse, you just don't understand how hard it was for me. It's not my fault, and I'm not blaming anyone. It is a disease. But how do you answer that? Like, something like, you know, oh, you just don't get how hard this is, or you wouldn't do this to me. How could you not talk to me?
Okay. Here's what's going on. You're speaking with an irrational person who believes that their case, their situation is unique, and that for some reason they're not like the other people that started their recovery and that quit their use. They think that there's something special about their use. So, and if that's a false belief, because anybody who wants to bad enough can quit. I don't care if they've been smoking meth for 15 years or they're an IV heroin user for a decade. Anybody that wants to bad enough can quit. So,
question, Joe, just quickly, when you say that, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what about if the person has some type of mental illness, like bipolar or something like that? Does that still apply?
Yes, it still applies. And here's the deal. A lot of these mental health issues, depression, bipolar, panic attacks, whatever, a lot of that is drug and alcohol related. Once the drug and alcohol abuse and use stops, many, many, many of these mental health, so to speak, problems will just sort of take care of themselves. Right now, an active alcoholic or drug addict that's been diagnosed as bipolar is almost like he's putting poison in his brain. He's just going to make things worse.
Right.
Nothing's going to get better until all the substances stop. And then after a period of time, if there's still all these symptoms of depression or bipolar, that might be a time to consider some type of medication. But not until, in my opinion, medication should be sort of a last resort. Let's try and deal with the primary number one problem first, which is drug abuse.
Okay, another question for you is, what if, you know, your adult child or, you know, the addict in your life says to you, once you have this agreement written out, well, if you don't speak to me, I'll kill myself.
Okay, well, that's a good, because that happens a lot, and that statement gets thrown around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, we don't really want to just, we want to take that somewhat seriously. And if my son or my daughter were in the living room telling me that if you won't let me stay here, if you won't help me, then I don't think life's worth living. I think I'll just end it. I would get on the phone and dial 911. And I would tell them, and they're going to say, what's your emergency? And you're going to say, well, my son has a drug problem, and he's in the home, and he's really upset, and he's threatening to harm himself or maybe even take his own life. And then let the chips fall where they may. Let the 911 person take it from there. They'll typically send out a police officer, see what's going on. And, once you've done this,
right,
that person will usually stop those threats, because 99.9% of all those threats are just attempts to make the parent feel guilty and to give in to the demand of the addict or the alcoholic. Now, again, we don't want to we want to take this somewhat seriously, but at the same time realizing that over 99% of those threats are just that. They're just veiled threats, a way to manipulate the parent to get what they want. So get professional people involved. Once you've done that, you can look back and say, well, we did everything we could do. We got the professional help. And like I said, it's scary, but it's so rare. I don't know.
Right. Would you say, Joe, that typical drug addicts are master manipulators of their families? So, like, if when they say things, even, well, I need this in order to stay clean, or if they call you from the street and I'm starving and you don't, all these things that they just know how to pull at their parents, heartstrings to try to get them to bend.
And it shows the extreme desperation to get the drug. I mean, they will do whatever they have to do. I think a lot of addicts and alcoholics could win Academy Awards with some of these presentations they make to get help from whoever, mom, grandma, sister, or brother. And if you sort of look at it like you're almost not even talking to your son or daughter, you're actually having a conversation with their disease, because their brain is saying, we have to do whatever we have to do. We'll make things up. We'll be dishonest. We'll do whatever we have to do to keep this rather than become completely drug-free. And that's a big fear for addicts and alcoholics. They say, I don't know anybody that doesn't use. I don't know who I would be around, or I haven't lived that lifestyle. I don't know how people live without some kind of substance. I mean, it looks really boring, but the goal is to force them into a corner where they have to try sobriety. And most people will realize it doesn't take too long that they can really do life okay on life's terms. Every day is not perfect, but they don't have to use if they don't want to. And the role of the mom, the dad
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The role is to help create the want to. In other words, you can't make the person quit. You can't make them stop. You can't cure it. But you can move them in the direction where they want to quit, because it's such a pain in the rear to keep going that they begin this journey of recovery.
Now, I wanted to ask you, let's say, in my case, this is my plan when he comes out, is that if, God forbid, he relapses, I am going to stick to the 30 days of no contact and so forth. Now, where I have a problem is, let's say we just play out a scenario. He comes out, he's clean a week, he relapses. Basically I give him a list of sober living environments that he can check himself into. I'm willing to pay, because of his age for the first month or two. Let's say a week after that he relapses, let's say again. When do I get to the point where I won't even, let's say, pay for that living thing? How do you know when even that's enough? Where you just say, now I've tried 3 times of sober living, you've walked out 3 times, now I'm just going to leave you on the street. I mean, how do you just know when enough is enough?
Well, the situation you just described would be enough. I mean, if he gets out and you tell him that, he has to maintain sobriety, he can't live here, there's a sober living home, you know, a mile away, and mm-hmm. and I've talked to the people, and they will admit you in. You know, you have to maintain your sobriety at a sober living home, because if you're using or if you bring drugs or alcohol in, they kick you out. Right.
So he gets kicked out.
So he gets kicked out, and he's now homeless.
Right.
So, again, he's going to make some calls. He's going to try and find a friend that will let him crash at their place. But eventually, the hope is that they just get tired of it. I mean, at this point, the alcohol and drug use is really not much fun. In fact, it's becoming almost like a second job just to maintain mm-hmm. substance use. So the hope is that they'll just weigh the pros and cons. I mean, whether they do it, you know, consciously or subconsciously, it doesn't really matter. At some point, the hope is that they realize it's just not worth it. It's just too hard to stay under the influence of substances, finding the money, finding the drugs. Even if it's alcohol, it's cheap and it's available everywhere, it's still, the fun is gone. And now there's more pain involved with use than what was once fun. Because early on in substance use, alcohol and drug experimentation, it is fun. I mean, it's a lot of fun. If it wasn't fun, nobody would even try it. So it is fun early on. The problem is that it becomes an insidious, harmful obsession to use, and the addict doesn't even see it coming. It's, you know, the word insidious is described as having a gradual or cumulative effect, being harmful, subtle, enticing. And then at the last part of Webster says it's well established before becoming apparent. So in other words, the addict or alcoholic didn't see it coming. And the next thing they know, it's deeply ingrained in their system, and now they try and deny it. Mm-hmm. So battling through all that for the mom or the parents or the spouse, whatever the case may be, it's tough. It's not easy. And sometimes the situation needs to get a little worse before it gets better. So if it's homeless, living in a homeless shelter, I mean, it's no fun living in a homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just a bunch of homeless, you know, not so nice people living in homeless shelters, and, you know, only a minuscule percentage go on to the bitter end. And so I guess the mom has to trust the process. I mean, this is what works. You know, the reason I have 33 years of sobriety is because my mother walked in one day and said, look, you have to either go to this treatment program and quit your drug use or get out, because we're not doing anything else for you.
And she meant it, you know, and that's the thing. Your mom meant it. She followed through.
Right.
I don't think I followed through. Like, he will test me when I say this, and let's say he goes to the sober living, he will get kicked out the first time. I absolutely know it, because I am an enabler. I have not stuck to what I've said. So
okay,
now
well,
he gets
here's what
kicked
you,
out.
Here's what
gone,
you do.
Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
What? When you see his number on your come up on your phone, on your caller ID, don't answer the call.
For how
Let
long?
Let it go to voicemail.
Okay, I won't answer. For how long?
What,
a month?
You,
I mean, like, how long?
You've already made the deal, 30 days of sobriety.
So how would I know that, Joe? Like, okay, so now let's say, you know, I'm trying to pin you down because it's so helpful to me. So, okay, he left the halfway house that I provided now, 30 days of sobriety. He's on the street now. How do I know that? Like, what you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, the drug testing kits, the sign-in sheet where he attends 12-step groups.
Okay.
You know, addicts and alcoholics, I mean, are not going to recover all on their own. They need support. They need encouragement. They need a group. That's why the 12-step stuff is so helpful. It's free. It's everywhere, and it's available all the time. You go morning, noon, or night.
And
so
what, Joe,
making him use this form to fill the form out and then calling the person that was the facilitator and say, you know, my son said he was at that meeting on Tuesday at noon. He was kind of a tall, lanky guy, a kid with brown hair. Do you remember him there? Oh, yeah, I signed his sheet. I remember him. So you have to verify. Right
so
now,
he would
can't
do that
trust
on the street, right? He would be on the street doing that for 30 days.
If that's
once
what
he
wants to do.
Out. Okay. But typically, and in her son's cases, what happens is there's like a cycle where he will last a couple of days on the street, but then he'll wind up at the hospital. And then once he's in the hospital, then he comes out and he stays clean. And then it's like, all right, we got to give him another chance now because now he's been clean. But he's not choosing to be clean. Like,
and
he's forced to be cleaned only because he's been in jail or a hospital. And then it starts all over as soon as he gets out again. So that's like,
that's a vicious cycle. That's where, if we back up now, what we talked about a minute ago was 30 days of sobriety. So, in other words, some way to verify that he has 30 days of sobriety, which the only way I know how to do that is drug testing. If he's in a sober living home, they're going to have drug testing. They're going to be able to tell whether he's sober or not, and attendance at 12-step groups. And until he has that 30 days of sobriety that's verifiable through drug testing, through attendance at 12-step groups, do not communicate with him.
Okay.
And that's 30 days
of hospital. If the hospital calls and says, you know, you're – your son's up here and he's detoxing off of heroin. Just say, well, I just do whatever you have to do because I'm not, you know, we have an agreement, and if he's chosen that lifestyle, I can't help him. So, and that's hard. I know it's hard, but you have to make yourself do that. Otherwise, you're going to be talking about this. Your 19-year-old son's going to be—he's going to be 29, and we're still talking about this.
You know, it's so—I just wanted to say, Joe, the difference is why it will be harder for me right now is because I did not stick to my word. So I know I'm writing this out because I had the wonderful, you know, ability to speak to you about this, and this is my plan. And I know it will be tested a couple of times because I have a pattern of rescuing him all these 3 years.
And you,
so
and
because,
you,
right, he's going to test me.
Right, and that's what you put in this. You don't want to just have a conversation because you want to have all your thoughts prepared and clearly in advance, written down on a sheet of paper. You give him a copy of this. You tell him just what you just got through telling me. What's your son's name?
Daniel,
you know, I know that in the past I've given you ultimatums. I told you I wasn't going to help you if you continued to use, but Daniel, this time – I know you may not believe it, but I really mean it this time. So this time, if you call me in a week or so, or someone calls me and says that you're in jail or you're in an emergency room, you're just on your own. I mean, I love you, and you know what I've been doing, which I thought was help, was really actually harm. You know what my helping is really going to help you to death if I don't stop it. So I decided I have to stop it because I want you to live and I want you to have an enjoyable life. I want you to be independent, confident, able to go out in the world, live on your own, pay your own bills, and enjoy life substance-free. So I really, really mean it this time. And I know that you might test me, but I'm telling you right now, if you call me in 3 days, when I see your number come up on the caller ID, I'm not taking the call. I'm not going to talk to you again until you have 30 days of verifiable sobriety. As much as I love you, I can't really trust you right now because you've broken trust in the past, so I need to be able to verify. And the verification is in the 12-step attendance, the random drug testing, and maintaining a living environment like a sober living home.
Well, you know, this has been a lifesaver. I just, you know, it was the one thing that you had told me. I'm actually taking notes because I'm preparing my agreement. My son will be out like in a week or so, whatever.
Right.
And this has actually shifted my perspective so much because I didn't know what to do. Like, you know, before I spoke to you, it was like, I don't have a plan. I mean, it's like, okay, it would be the same cycle. Christina's been with me, you know, we've been best friends for 2 years, and she's seen me over and over and over, keep going to the hospitals, keep taking him out, keep paying for him. And I to reiterate, on this call, I want to just step by step, just, you know, say exactly what we said just one more time, the plan and the letter and the whole thing, just like step 1, 2, 3, and 4, because I just think it's going to save so many lives.
Sure. Okay. Well, it starts out with this letter of concern. And when I say letter of concern, this is not a hateful letter. It's just a matter-of-fact letter. Daniel, I love you. You're my own son. You're my flesh and blood. I raised you from a child. I really care for you, and I really want the best for you. I want you to be able to go out and function in society independently, enjoy life, substance-free, maybe get married, have a family, all those kinds of things that most people do. I want that for you. But what I'm not going to do from this point forward, and you must get 30 days of monitored, verifiable sobriety. And the only way that I know how to do that is through this form and through random drug testing or living in a sober living home. Now, so between now and the time that when you have that 30 days of verifiable sobriety, then I'd like to have a coffee with you. I want to we'll meet at Starbucks and we'll talk about what the future holds for us. But everything hinges on your willingness to maintain sobriety, because you have proven multiple times that you cannot control your use, and it's painful to watch. And I'm choosing not to watch it. So don't call, don't text, and don't come by the house for at least 30 days until you have that 30 days of verifiable, monitored sobriety. And at that point, we'll see what goes. And you know, Daniel, this is hard for me. I'm your mother. It's going to be hard to not take your calls. If your number comes up on the caller ID, I'm not going to take the call. I want you to know that right now, so that you don't have to waste your time calling or texting, because I'm not going to respond to it until, like, today is the 2nd of the month. So the 2nd of next month, if you have 30 days of sobriety, that will be the next time that you and I chat.
That is terrific.
Between now and then, we're talking about 4 weeks of maintaining sobriety.
Quick question,
if you're not willing to do... Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask you, you made one point about coming to the house. What do you do if they show up at the house? Like, if he shows up at the house, what do you do? Like, if someone's if he's ringing the bell and showing up, or, you know, maybe even throwing something at your house, what do you do?
Well, if he's throwing anything at the house, or if he's causing if there's any concern of his anger getting out of control, then call 911.
Okay. That's
Pick
what I wanted
to
know.
I called 911. Twice on my son in one day.
Wow. Okay. I wanted to know, like, that, what you thought about that, because I know my son will show up at the house.
Tell him. I mean, tell him.
In the letter.
You can tell him
in
advance that he can't come by the house. I don't want to see you. I don't want to talk to you until you have 30 days of verifiable, monitored sobriety. So if you show up here in 3 days, I'm not going to answer the door. And if you get angry and you really start fussing and yelling and banging on the door, I'm going to call 911.
Okay. So you put that
and
in
then
the
do
letter.
It.
And you put it in the letter.
Sure.
Like, explain it, which is wonderful, because he did break my door like last year. Okay, but so that's the plan. You put in the letter everything that you're going to do in every different scenario, like you just explained, in a loving, kind way, and stick to it.
Right, correct.
Okay. That's
and the sticking to it is hard, and that's why we talked about, you know, encouragement from like-minded moms that are going through the same stuff. So sticking to it's hard. You know, we had a curfew for my son when he was like 14 or 15. You know, on the weekends we said he needed to be in by midnight, and he would say, "Well, that's too early." I said, "Well, what would work for you, Jake?" "Well, 1 o'clock. Can I stay? Stay out till 1 o'clock. But here's the deal." If you come in after 1 o'clock, the house is locked up, and we're going to sleep, and we're not going to answer the door. So you can either sleep in the car or go someplace else to sleep. Well, he would come in 1:30, 2 o'clock. He'd start banging on the door, ringing the doorbell.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife says, we would just put the pillows over our ears and just let him bang on it for a while until he finally quit banging. Now, you don't hear about kids that just died in the street because they couldn't get in the house one night. I mean, they figure it out.
Right.
Like, in the case of my son, he walked a couple miles to a buddy's house, and they let him in, and he stayed there.
But I bet he learned his lesson.
I'm sorry?
He learned his lesson. He probably was on time after that.
He was either on time, or he just stayed. Wherever he was staying, he stayed all night.
Right.
But you know, because, I mean, literally, it's hard to go to sleep if you're waiting for your kid to come in. So, I mean, at some point, at like 1 o'clock, you say, "Well, we're going to sleep, honey." And if he comes, he's going to learn a hard lesson. I mean, you can put a sleeping bag in the car and a blanket and tell him to sleep in the car or whatever, but you're not opening the door. And he would pound on that door. And we would just let him pound.
Well, this has been absolutely amazing. I think you've answered every single question that I have for my own plan that I plan to put in place in 5 days.
Good.
And it has been absolutely eye-opening for me. It gives me hope. It encourages me because, you know, I now have a plan of mine, you know, where I didn't.
Right.
And I don't know, Christina, if you have any other questions.
For me was something that you said, and I think every mother who's listening to this needs to hear those words, is that you can actually basically, you know, love your child to death by enabling your child.
Me?
I mean,
right.
You can harm your child, and I think that could be the somebody for everybody to really hear those words and understand that. And when you feel weak of giving in, remember that you are harming your child by giving in,
right.
That you could be killing
right.
your child by giving in, and that's very
right.
serious. But if you keep that in your head, that maybe will give you the strength not to pick up the phone or not to give money. Because no, as mothers, we love our children, and we don't want to do anything to hurt them. So I think
right.
putting it in that perspective, I think, could be very eye-opening and very important tool for mothers
right.
to use.
Right, especially after you've shared these deep concerns and you've made a forceful, sound argument for your case and that you're going to stick with it. After you've done all that, the ball's in their court, and they can either choose to swallow their pride, humble themselves, and seek help for their drug addiction, or they can just fumble around for a longer period of time. But eventually, most of them do figure it out. They just
right.
Do.
And you brought up some great points, even for people. I mean, this is for people who are at the end of their rope, but there's going to be people who are listening to this or maybe, you know, in the beginning stages of it.
Mm-hmm.
This advice as far as sticking your ground, like you said with the curfew example, was a perfect example. You
right.
know, don't start young letting them get away with stuff because it'll escalate into a very, very serious situation where you'll be at the end of your rope someday. So setting
right.
boundaries and being firm as a parent, I think, is really important.
You know, and
yeah,
go ahead, Jeff.
Absolutely. And, you know, the whole thing boils down to the mindset of the parent. I mean, the mom, the spouse, whatever, once they really, once this goes into the brain that this is the right thing to do. I mean, you can say it's hard, but it's the right thing to do. Say that over and over and over, and you'll become convinced
flash
yourself
flood.
That I'm doing the right thing.
Right, it is the right thing to do.
Right.
As hard as it may be, it is.
And I wanted to ask in closing one last question because you had said to me the other day when we spoke, you said that if parents, and usually it's the mom, you know, that enables a lot of the time, if we don't take control, can you explain the severity of what probably, you know, like will happen over the years with somebody who's this, well, you know, who's somebody, we're talking about somebody with chronic drug use, it'll escalate to probably a fatal point. Am I correct?
In a minuscule number of cases, yes, it will.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very small number. I mean, some
okay.
people will maybe stay stuck in this. I mean, you may implement your 30-day approach to their sobriety and, you know, it may be 6, 8, 10 months later before it finally clicks in.
Mm-hmm.
But that's better than 6 or 8 or 10 years later.
Right.
You know, left unchecked, addiction gets progressively worse over time. The tolerance level goes up. People use more and more. The chance of some type of overdose goes up. The chance of doing some permanent brain damage goes up. So you're literally trying to save the person's life. And pain, addicts and alcoholics learn so much through pain that they just don't seem to learn in any other way. So allowing maybe a little increase in pain right now can save many, many years, decades of pain spread out over the next several years. So a little tougher now with the hope and belief that this will really work, and it usually does. I mean, it usually does work. I mean, that's what addicts and alcoholics, they need. They need an ultimatum. They need to be told we're done. Even if you don't think that you have that kind of a problem, we're convinced you do, and I think that you'll see the light sooner rather than later.
This has been
That's
terrific.
Wonderful.
This has been such a wonderful, wonderful interview. I thank you
very
much.
Thank you, Joe. It has been very enlightening. And
well, I'm glad
so
to be on
people.
Addict's Mom. You
okay,
guys are doing a great work, too.
But I wanted to ask you, Joe, how do people find out more about what you're doing, about your book, about your site? How do, like, you know, could you give us some information about yourself?
Well, we have a couple of websites. One of them is called changinglivesfoundation.org. And on that site, there's a ton of free resources, information, articles, other radio shows where I've talked about different topics. So all that is free off of that site. And there's a link there. It'll say if you're interested in the book, my book, Why Don't They Just Quit? There's a link you can click on that talks about how to buy a book. And we also have a DVD called The 10 Toughest Questions That Families Ask. That's available off of our website. But really, the education process, becoming informed about what's really going on, it's a little bit of work for the parents. They need to read a few books, watch a couple DVDs, go to some support groups. But this information is critical for that mind change that needs to take place and for the parent to see that, you know, maybe they're doing more harm than good. So my book, Why Don't They Just Quit, is available there. And there's many links, many more resources right off of that changinglivesfoundation.org.
And I've read your book and watched your DVD, and it's fantastic. I highly recommend it to everyone that's going to be listening to this call. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Bye. Bye-bye.